Mr. Rowe.
Thank you. May it please the Court. In this case, the appellants, the Edgar County and Michael McFatrick, seek coverage through various insurance policies issued by...
Before we get too far into the merits, Mr. Rowe, I have a question about appellate jurisdiction.
Okay.
Circuit Rule 30 requires the appellant to include in the appendix to the brief a copy of the district court's judgment. I looked for that in your brief, didn't find it.
I believe, Your Honor, that would be A-9 and A-13. A-9 is the original order on summary judgments. A-13 is the...
Order on summary judgment is not a judgment of a district court. Judgment is the thing that complies with Rule 58 and terminates the case. And I ask that in particular because when I went and tried to find a judgment, I found something dated April 18, 2008, which just says, this case is terminated. And that gave me some pause, because this is a declaratory judgment action. National Casualty sought a declaratory judgment on certain issues and does not appear to have received one, which suggests to me that this case hasn't been completed, hasn't been wrapped up in the district court. The district court still needs to enter the declaratory judgment. Now, is there some judgment other than the judgment of April 18 that actually includes the declaratory judgment?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. Now that you mention that, I do record seeing that it's kind of a pre-printed form that was entered by the court, but I believe that's the only one that has been entered.
Declaratory judgments are not pre-printed forms. There is a Rule 58 form on which the district court might enter the declaratory judgment. Now, I'll ask Mr. Craney this question, but if there isn't a declaratory judgment, I don't see how we have jurisdiction. This case needs to be finished in the district court.
It would seem, though, that the court's rulings are included in the orders that it entered.
Judgment is a document separate from the opinion. You seem to be under the view that a court's opinion is the same thing as its judgment, and that's not the way federal practice works. I seriously doubt that that's the way state practice works, but it is assuredly not the way federal practice works.
In order to obtain an obligation to defend, a person seeking only has to show that any claim is covered by any policy.
I've actually got a second question that the briefs don't pay any attention to, and it's, I don't understand how these policies cover the supposed wrong. Under Heck against Humphrey, this claim accrued in 2003. That's when the prisoner was released, when Stiebel was released. But none of these policies extends to 2003. You seem to believe that the policy covers the period of imprisonment, and at least so far as I can make out, that's not what Illinois law provides. The Illinois Court of Appeals held in a case called Security Mutual Casualty Company against Harbor Insurance that the claim accrues for the purpose of figuring out policy coverage when, under Heck, the federal court says it does. And if that's so, this case is just a non-starter, is it not?
Your Honor, if you examine the occurrence definitions in the occurrence takes place when the wrongful act that inflicts damage occurs. That would have been, in the first instance, when Mr. Steidel was convicted of the double murder, sentenced to death.
So you think the Illinois appellate court doesn't understand Illinois law?
I believe that...
Our general view is that we have to follow decisions of Illinois courts on Illinois law.
I have not reviewed the decision the court refers to, but I believe in the insurance law context, it's when the acts occur which cause damage. I believe I cited the case involving the plumbing materials in which the court held it's the date when the damage manifests itself. Here, the plaintiff's main claim of damages is that he was thrown on death row and ultimately served about 20 years in prison.
I'm sure that's right, but there's just a technical question here about if you have a claim for malicious prosecution, when does it accrue as a matter of Illinois law? Does it accrue when the guy is thrown into prison or when the guy is let out? And Illinois law appears to say the claim accrues when he's let out.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but malicious prosecution is not the only claim pled by Mr. Steudle in this case.
But what would indicate that anyone contemplated coverage for acts by someone who is a former employee of the county or state? That seems, you know, a very unusual argument that the parties to these insurance contracts anticipated covering wrongful acts by a private citizen who used to be a government employee.
Your Honor, what the main policy we're relying on, the comprehensive law enforcement liability policy, was in effect while Mike McFatridge served as state's attorney. It was in effect 5/25/89 through 5/25/90. Mr. McFatridge left office, I believe, at the end of 1990. So that policy was in effect while Mr. McFatridge served as state's attorney. One additional policy provides that it specifically covers former employees, and it also provides for coverage of civil rights claims, though that particular policy does not cover malicious prosecution and things of that nature.
Is the state's attorney considered an employee of the county or an employee of the state?
Well, it's not as simple as that, Your Honor.
I know it isn't. I once held a position, and I was curious as to how I'd be classified.
For purposes of asserting a tort claim in state court, they are held to be state employees, and the claim must be filed in the court of claims. But that doesn't really completely answer the question. For example, I'm an officer of the court. I'm an employee of the law firm that hired me. I'm also an agent of the clients who retained me in this case. You can wear different hats. If you look at the cases in which decide that cases against the state's attorney must go to the court of claims, they really don't analyze employment in terms of the common law thresholds and definitions of employment. In fact, this is the last Illinois Supreme Court case to discuss. The state's attorney didn't refer to him as state employees, but referred to him as constitutional officers. So I don't think
that struck me as being a better definition.
It may be, but that doesn't rule out the possibility that they may also be
may be
employees for purposes of insurance coverage. If you look at the various incidents of employment as combined or compared to the common law criteria for determining employment, the state pays 2/3 of a state's attorney's salary. The county pays 1/3. The county is obligated to furnish the state's attorney with an office and staff. The state's attorney is obligated to perform certain legal services for county officers at their request. No one from the state of Illinois, not even the governor, not even the attorney general, has a right to fire or discipline a state's attorney.
Amen.
The only people who can fire a state's attorney are basically, I guess they could be impeached, but basically the voters of the county.
Don't discipline us either, but that doesn't make us employees of Edgar County.
But you are an employee, I think, Your Honor, of the United States of America, though. Even though the president can't fire you, I believe you're federal employees. I mean,
well, somebody can fire him. This isn't a matter called impeachment, which takes care of the problem. He's not in danger at the moment.
It just seems so unlikely that parties to insurance policies would anticipate that the policies, four of them here, would cover a state's attorney who is, from what I can garner, probably a state rather than a county employee, and would cover him for acts that occurred long after he left office. I mean, it's very hard to unravel all of this, I must say. You know, you've got four different policies and all the... Somebody must know if state's attorneys are county employees or state employees. There must be a case somewhere. Is there not?
There are cases holding that if a person wants to sue a state's attorney, they must go to the court of claims. They can't go to the circuit court. But that doesn't analyze whether, for purposes of insurance of insurance policy, they may not also be employees of the county, because they are obligated, the counties are obligated to pay a portion of their salaries, burning some office space.
You mean they can be working as an agent of the county when they are working as a constitutional state officer as well?
Right. It's just like I'm an employee of the law firm.
I understand your position.
Right. And
but you're in your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think I will sit down and save my rebuttal time. I didn't know this at all.
Jeez.
Thank you, Mr. Rao. Mr. Craney.
May it please the Court. In a nutshell, our position is that there are four insurance policies.
I do think we need to start with jurisdiction. That is logically first, so I hope you will address it.
My belief is that having looked at the documents and listening to the Court's commentary, it does appear that there was not a formal judgment entered in the case. There was a subsequent, I believe there was a docket order, or there was verbiage at the end of the initial order that said...
There are two possibilities if there was no declaratory judgment. One is that the case is not final, and the other is that the case is final, but you're the losing party because you sought a declaratory judgment and didn't get it. So you should be appealing, asking us to direct the district court to enter a declaratory judgment, and the county should be defending.
Well, certainly our...
Obviously we can't do that because you didn't file a cross appeal.
Certainly our position is that we did not lose
Well, you asked for a declaratory judgment. Did you get one?
We have not gotten one at this
point.
All right.
Well, you lost. Unless your view is that the judgment is not final, and in that event, I assume that what you'll be doing this afternoon is repairing to the district court and asking the court to enter a proper declaratory judgment in this case, from which the county will then appeal.
Well, certainly that's what we'll do.
Well, there seems to be a fact question regarding whether the state's attorney is an employee of the county or the state. You know, we've heard that some of the salary comes from the county, some from the state. State's attorney, of course, is elected by the county, obliged to work as the county's attorney. Do you think we need a hearing to determine who employs state's attorney? I mean, how do we figure it out?
Well, I believe that that can be decided as a matter of law, and I disagree that the cases that we've cited for the prop. I think it's clear that under Illinois case law, a state's attorney is a state employee, not a county employee. There are several cases that say that. They've all been cited in our motion. Opposing counsel has pointed out that to some extent those cases deal with a jurisdictional issue. The jurisdictional issue about whether a lawsuit must be brought in the court of claims or the district or the state court, that's an afterthought. The analysis that's set out in those cases goes to what judicial article or what article of the Constitution creates the position. They relied upon the Carver case in a different context. They relied upon that to sort of make the argument that the county isn't insured under some of these other policies. But Carver, to the extent they relied upon it in this matter at all, sort of demonstrates why their argument fails. Carver talks about a sheriff, and it points out that a sheriff is empowered under Section 7, I believe, of the Constitution, whereas state's attorneys fall under the judicial Section 6, and because of that, the cases uniformly hold that they are employees of the state.
Well, why did our district judge go to Black's Dictionary if it's all so clear?
Well, I wouldn't presume to speak on behalf of the judge, but it is our position that the cases do uniformly point out that the state's attorney is an employee of the state. I do not believe, to answer Your Honor's question of a few minutes ago, I do not believe that a hearing is required, because I believe that these facts that have been raised by the appellants, you know, how the state's attorney is paid and other things like that, I don't think those are relevant to the analysis. I think what's relevant to the analysis...
I know that you don't think it's relative because you ignored the claim that the county paid part of McFetridge's salary and that McFetridge was obliged to provide legal representation to the county. So, but... sitting here, I don't know who you know who his master was. We all have to have
doesn't
a master.
Have any. Go ahead.
What?
Doesn't have any. Go ahead. He's an independent elected officer. He doesn't owe anything to anyone.
So just can run free and wild.
Well, until he's brought up to a dead halt by some brilliant jurist, but go ahead.
Kendrick, your day has come.
In any event, I would also point out that there's a second layer and probably a more important layer to this whole analysis, and whether he's an employee, and we contend he's not, and I think that's clear, goes to the issue of whether McFatridge is an insured under any of these policies. There's a separate issue the court hit upon a few minutes ago, which is whether or not there has been an occurrence under any of these policies. There's essentially three causes of action: false arrest, malicious prosecution, and false imprisonment. And under Illinois law, the three triggering events that correspond to those would be the date of arrest, the date of incarceration, and the date that he was released. And the two first events happened long before our policies were in effect, and the third happened, as the court has pointed out, after our policies were in effect. So there just can be no occurrence over and above the fact that that as I've indicated, this individual wasn't insured. And the final argument I would just quickly point out, they are focused on this first policy, the one from 1989 to 1990. There's an exclusion in there for willful acts in violation of statutes. I'm not quoting it, obviously, accurately, but we believe the exclusion that's set out in our brief applies. But that's sort of a supplemental issue. The first issue and foremost is there's not an occurrence under the policies, and secondly, we don't believe that any of these individuals are insured under the policies. So if there are no further questions,
I have 1,000 questions. I'm just trying to formulate them because, you know, you've got four insurance policies. Not one of them is a model of clarity, but I always think that, certainly with my own, and even though McFetrid stopped working as the state's attorney in 1991, it looks as if, you know, it's alleged that he continued to harm Stadel's efforts to overturn his wrongful conviction for many, many years. I just threw my arms up.
I guess what I would say about that is that almost uniformly these policies are occurrence-based policies. There are a few endorsements to the last chronological policy, which are claims-made policies, but there's been no allegation anywhere in the case that a claim was made back then. So we're talking about occurrence-based policies. And under an occurrence-based policy, the law in Illinois is clear and it tracks the law in almost every jurisdiction that I'm aware of that says, among other things, that it's when the harm occurs. So that gets us back to the basic point, that the triggering event arises from the harm. And the harms under these three causes of action, or these three theories, are the date of incarceration, the date of arrest, and the date that he's released, none of which happened within our policy period. Although I understand that there are allegations that this person, you know, as unsubstantiated as they may be, was running around doing whatever he was doing, that does not trigger, in and of itself, trigger coverage under any of the policies. Now, the other issue that the appellant has raised is this Carver case, and there's only one claim or one count here directed to the county of Edgar. And they are attempting to assert this argument that because the county may be responsible for paying some sort of judgment, that they're trying to bootstrap in this idea that somehow the county is now insured under the policy. But that misses the mark, because the issue is there an occurrence under the policy? And the fact that somebody I'm not even sure it's clear, but the fact that someone may have to indemnify the state's attorney for their actions does not constitute a triggered occurring event under the policy. It's not an occurrence.
But I take it you do concede that the law enforcement policy was in effect from May 25, 1989 to May 25, 1990, when McFetridge was still the state's attorney, right?
That policy was in effect during that time, correct. However, we have two issues. Number one, McFetridge was not an insured under that policy because he wasn't an employee of the city. That gets us into this argument about Class C employees.
Right.
State, county.
County, I'm sorry. He wasn't an employee of the county, and the appellants have pointed to the definition in the policy of the various classes of employees as evidence. That's not dispositive. It's not a definitional section, so it doesn't say who is an employee and who is not. It's more of an underwriting guideline, but they've pointed to this category of Class C employees as evidence that the state's attorney should be deemed to be an employee of that policy. The Class C employee definition is those employees who do not exercise power of arrest and whose duties are only administrative in nature. And this, unfortunately, happens to be an area where there is no case law on point. But if you look at the relevant statutes, which we've set out in our brief, defining the duties of a state's attorney, I find it strains logic to say that their duties are only administrative in nature.
Of course, what a coroner does would hardly fit the definition of administration either. I mean, it's true, of course, a coroner has to run an office, but the core work of the coroner is determining the cause of death. I mean, ambiguous provisions are always read in the insured's favor, are they not, in Illinois?
Well, they are. I don't think there's anything ambiguous about this because, again, I don't think the definition that's set out in Class C is what's controlling here. It's the definition found under the provision, who is an insured. And if you look at the definition of who is an insured, it's clear that you have to have someone who is an employee of the county, the named insured, which was County of Edgar and
Boy,
the Sheriff's Department.
Boy, if this isn't a chicken and egg problem, I don't know what is.
I think the most important inquiry is the occurrence issue. Have there been any occurrences under these policies? That's what the district court looked at in this case and the related case, TIG, I guess Steidl versus TIG. In any case, there are three measuring points for these causes of action: the date of arrest, the date of incarceration, and the date of release. And if you look at the NICOR case, which is cited in here, it provides a good treatment of how we look at different causes of action under Illinois law. And some of them are continuing trigger type cases, and some of them are not. And what the appellants have done here is try to bootstrap in this idea of a continuing trigger type case, which would be more applicable to things such as, you know, asbestos release, toxic torts. And then you get a gray area, and they've cited this Roman Catholic diocese case where there was an ongoing pattern of sexual molestation. And in that case, it was true that an appellate court in Illinois said, well, in this case, we will continue this to be sort of an ongoing event. But the issue there was, and NICOR gives a good treatment of this, the issue there was it was a completely different cause of action. It was just a standard, I shouldn't say standard, but it was a personal injury case, and they were unable to identify when the injuries arose. The courts have consistently said that in these types of cases, these being false arrest, malicious prosecution, we do know when the injury occurs. We do know when the cause of action accrues. It's at the time of the arrest, the incarceration, and the release. And so on that basis alone, it provides a very simple and easy-to-understand measurement tool to show that, you know, there is no occurrence that fell within any of the policies that we had.
Let me just ask you this. Does the state's attorney of Cook County, does Anita Alvarez, is she a state employee or a county employee?
She's, according to the Constitution of Illinois, she is a state employee.
Mm-hmm.
She can be acting, however, as a county agent when she's representing the county. And when she takes action in criminal cases, it's in the name of the people of the state of Illinois. She takes action on behalf of the county of Cook, it's on behalf of the county of Cook, and it's clearly defined that way. And it's a lawsuit that is filed by the county is named to the county of Cook, as it would be County Edgar, in which case she's operating in a capacity as a county agent, although still a state constitutional officer. She has to represent the county attorney. That's why she represents the county officers.
And
but not as this employee of the state, as a employee of the, or at that moment as an agent of the county, like a lawyer had been hired. They pay her a third of her salary.
And I think I would agree with that analysis, Your Honor. And I would point out that in this case,
get to what they're doing. It's two different capacities.
And in this case, McBattridge was operating for the state because it was the people versus.
Well, there's no question. It's a criminal case. It's better be on behalf of the people in the state of Illinois.
There are no further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Ruff?
It may well be the case, Your Honor, that Carver does not apply to a state's attorney. In fact, as I no doubt will argue that at summary judgment stage in the underlying case. But for now, the trial judge has ruled that Carver does apply and a cause of action can be stated against the county under Carver for the state's attorney's actions. If there is any ambiguity as to whether McFatridge was a state employee or county employee, that ambiguity must be resolved in favor of finding coverage. The county had, the insurance carrier, they could have defined employee. They could have defined employee having certain characteristics. They could have defined employee to eliminate the possibility that the state's attorney could be an employee. But they didn't do that. They left this ambiguity. What triggers an occurrence in a coverage case is not necessarily the evaluation of the cause of action. It's what's pled in the complaint. In the complaint, Mr. Seidel pleads within the coverage of the comprehensive law enforcement policy, wrongful acts on behalf of McFatridge, which he claims causes him harm. I don't think the court can go beyond what is pled in the underlying case to determine whether or not a duty to defend exists. Otherwise, you would be evaluating and kind of ruling on the underlying case when you're ruling only on a duty to defend. It's the pleadings in the underlying case which control whether a duty to defend exists, not necessarily an evaluation of the cause of action, as you might on a motion to dismiss. The law enforcement policy does exclude intentional action coverage. However, it specifically includes sections under 1983 and similar civil rights laws. At least three of the plaintiff's complaints in the underlying case seek recovery under Section 1983. So I think there's clearly the exclusion may apply to some claims, but it certainly does not apply to the 1983 claims. And I would also point out with regard to an employee whose duties are solely administrative, I believe the court pointed out a coroner doesn't fall within that. A mayor, who's also a defined Class C employee, has even greater discretion than does a coroner. So I think the real test is solely administrative functions with regard to core law enforcement activities, such as carrying a gun and making arrests. There, both coroners, both state's attorneys provide administrative support to the police. State's attorneys by getting search warrants, providing legal.
Coroner is described as a peace officer, and he can arrest the sheriff. Matter of fact, he's the only one in the county that can't arrest.
I believe that's the common law rule. I don't know if that has been incorporated into the statute, though.
It is
though.
Incorporated. It is still alive and well in Illinois.
If that should ever come up. The court has no further questions.
Coroner, he's got a gun.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.